Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento City Council member and Mayor Pro Tem Angelique Ashby wants to be the next state senator for District 6. District 6, currently represented by Dr. Richard Pan, covers a large area, including Sacramento, West Sacramento, and Elk Grove. Dr. Pan is being termed out, and now a host of well-known Sacramentans are jumping into the race. In addition to Ashby, her colleague on the city council, Eric Guetta, has announced he's running, along with Sacramento pastor and activist T. Coy Porter and former California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones. Now, a quick editorial note to pass along. We have booked T. Coy Porter for next Thursday's Insight show. Dave Jones is on June 3rd, and we're working with Eric Guetta's team to get him on Insight soon as well. So that said, we're going to dig into the issues with today's guest, Angelique Ashby. Councilmember and Mayor Pro Tem Ashby, thank you for joining us on Insight.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Well, you've been on the City Council since 2010. You're the longest serving member on the Sacramento City Council. In order to run for the state Senate, you're going to have to leave your seat on the City Council. What convinced you to take that chance?
I know, it's scary. I love serving on the City Council, and I love being a part of Sacramento's leadership, but it's time. First of all, I've been there for, my 11th year. So by the time, all of this rolls around, I will have spent 12 years serving on the Sacramento City Council. And I love it so much. This is such a great city full of wonderful people, but I'm ready to serve on a bigger scale. I've had this amazing relationship with Dr. Pan for a decade. So I know what it's like to have a partnership with a great state elected official. And I'd like to be that state elected official as he leaves so that I can give back and work with the local electeds, both at the city and county and in our school districts, to help provide resources and policy direction that can drive Sacramento forward.
In 2016, you challenged fellow Democrat Daryl Steinberg for mayor. Mayor Steinberg ultimately won. What lessons from the mayoral campaign did you learn?
So I've been in a lot of races. I've won most of them, lost that one. But you know what? You learn so much more when you lose. It's hard. Nobody wants to lose, but you learn so much more. And Mayor Steinberg is a wonderful human being. We have a great relationship. There are a lot of things in my life that would have been different had I won. Probably the biggest of which is that right after that race, my father was diagnosed with dementia. And I actually spent the next 4 years with him, and I lost him in November. So I sometimes tell Mayor Steinberg that he was my angel because he gave those years back to me. But I also learned a lot on that campaign. It was a great campaign, hard work, uphill battle to run against a former president of the Senate and to, with so many more resources than I had. But I learned how to reach every corner of this city. And, I've learned a lot from serving with him as well. And I think all of those things will help me in this race.
Have you asked Mayor Steinberg for his endorsement?
I'm sure that I don't want to put him on the spot. Actually, I do. I love putting Daryl on the spot. It's one of my favorite things to do. He has been very supportive so far, but he hasn't made an endorsement yet. I do hope that he will support me before the end of this race. Yes.
You did get the endorsement of the incumbent state senator, Dr. Richard Pan, who is terming out. He was with you yesterday. What does that mean to you?
Oh, I can't even put words to it. First of all, just to have the endorsement of the outgoing incumbent is always great. But to have the endorsement of somebody like Dr. Pan, he's an amazing human being. I know what he's put into being the senator. I know what he's sacrificed. He's a pediatrician. He's so smart and kind. He's done such a great job, a true healthcare hero. To have somebody like that believe in you is so affirming. And I am grateful to Dr. Pan. I'm grateful to him for being a wonderful partner the entire time that I've been an elected. And I'm really grateful to him for helping me just see my own potential. He's an amazing man. We're lucky to have had him.
You did say yesterday there's a need for more diversity in local leadership, more voices from women in leadership. If elected, you would become the first woman to hold the seat in two decades, or more than two decades, really, since Senator Deborah Ortiz in 1998. But there's also a very diverse candidate pool. You have two individuals of color. Eric Guerra is Latino. Tikoi Porter is African-American. Senator Pan is Asian-American. So what does this say to you that, you know, of this diversity and the diverse candidate pool that you're competing against?
Yeah, so Deborah Ortiz was reelected 4 years after that. And so she served, you know, for a while as well. But yes, it's been almost two decades since a woman has won that seat. But here's the important thing to remember. It's not just that seat. There are three other assembly seats that represent Sacramento that are held by men right now. And they've been held by men that whole time as well. We've elected nine different men in that almost two decade period and no women to any of those seats. And in that same period of time, for the last 11 years, six of those years I spent as the only woman on the Sacramento City Council. This region is not doing a great job of elevating women. And I think that's important. I think it's critically important. I've had so many battles around equity and diversity and the pay gap and lifting women up. I mean, I fought for homeless women and children to get funding, equitable funding to programs that don't serve women and children for the last 5 years. I think it is critical that Sacramento choose a woman for some of these seats moving forward. I really do.
You are facing three other Democrats. What's going to set you apart from them?
Well, first is the obvious one that we just talked about, that I'm the only woman. But also, you know, having Dr. Pan's endorsement is really big. And then, you know, there's just who I am. I've been doing this at the local level for over a decade. One person hasn't served at all in office. And the other, one of the others is in local office now, but is fairly new. And the other one served many years at the state level, but quite some time ago. So I'm the person right now who looks at this through a local lens. I'm the person who knows what the homeless issue is at the local level and how much more difficult that is for us without state help. So we've actually gotten some traction in the last year, largely because of Project Room Key, which is the state giving us resources to address the problem. I understand our housing crisis, but I also know that the loss of redevelopment is why we don't have funding for low and very low income families. So we need somebody who's going to go back to the Capitol there and start to fight for those resources for the local level to be successful in implementation on these very difficult issues. I am the candidate who can bridge that gap. I am the one who has spent 10 years fighting those battles and has the relationships and the wherewithal to go to the Capitol and make a difference for our region.
What are the main issues and specific issues that you have that are going to set you apart?
Well, housing is definitely a big one. I represent a new growth area now. I understand how difficult it is to build housing. I was a single mom when I was 20 years old in this city. I used food stamps and lived in subsidized low-income housing. And I used Child Action, which is a subsidized child care program, to help put myself through UC Davis undergrad and McGeorge Law School. And I raised my son on my own and I worked full time during the day. So I understand what it is to be a grown up adult that lives in low income housing in this city. I know how important it is. I've also been on the side of being the council member who builds it. I have the most low income inclusionary apartment complexes in the city in my district. And I know that right now, under our current funding structure, we can't build them. So somebody's got to go to the state and get that funding source back. That's a big issue for me. I think addressing homelessness, particularly focusing on women and children and families that are homeless and getting them off the streets, we ought to be able in this state to get to a functional zero, which means no homeless women, children, and families on our streets. We are wealthy enough in California to achieve that goal, and we should be able to do it. I plan on focusing on that. Addressing the pay gap, standing up for women, equity. Yesterday, a young girl was a speaker at my event, and she talked about entering the STEAM world and being talked over by her male colleagues and told things she already knows and wanting to have female representation at the state highest levels to speak up for women. I want to be that voice.
Looking back when you were running for mayor in Sacramento in 2016, you did receive some criticism from activists and organizers at that time looking for police reform. You received an endorsement from a local police unit. I just want to ask, because obviously the conversation surrounding police reform and criminal justice and racial justice has evolved significantly in that time. And it's now shaping bills, legislation at the state legislature. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. And yes, how you have evolved in that time.
Yes, absolutely. First of all, I have evolved. So I think that's an important place to start. But also, I've used my relationships to try to advance conversations around social justice. So here are some of the things that I personally have championed in the city of Sacramento. I wrote the ordinance for our officers to wear body cameras. Sacramento Police Department is the only police department in the region that every officer wears body cameras. I wrote that policy. I also wrote the Oversight Commission policy. So the fact that we have an Oversight Commission was written by me on an ad hoc that I led. I also brought forward Brianna's Law, which Sacramento passed, the first big city in California to pass Brianna's Law, which ends no-knock raid warrants. It's how Breonna Taylor lost her life. I also co-sponsored with my colleague, Councilmember Larry Carr, the 8 That Can't Wait platform being adopted by Sacramento. 8 That Can't Wait, of course, being the Black Lives Matter national platform for police reforms. So I have used my relationships to push that dialogue forward. And then most recently, the city council has taken up this effort to change some of the use of force definition and when it can be used. And Mayor Steinberg and I have led on that dialogue and will continue to lead along with many of our other colleagues, including Councilmember Valenzuela. And I'm proud. I'm proud to be in a leadership role. I'm proud to push on the edges of that relationship. The need for reform to our criminal justice system is evident. At one time in my life, I worked in the public defender's office while I was still a law student here in Sacramento County. And I had the opportunity at that time to actually represent folks in the system as a public defender. And it's my natural leaning, my natural tendency to still lean that way. So I think that I have a broad vision for criminal justice. And I like to think of all the ways that we can work to reduce recidivism rates, to reduce incarceration numbers, to improve the relationship between the community and the police department on the front end, to utilize agencies like probation to help folks get the help that they need, housing and resources and jobs, rather than to be so punitive. We need to work far more on rehabilitative measures than we are on punitive measures.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with candidate for State Senate District 6, Sacramento City Council member and Mayor Pro Tem Angelique Ashby. All right, so now turning to money. California, as you know, has a huge surplus of cash, record setting, in fact. What in your mind are the top priorities you would advocate for if you were elected to the Senate seat?
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, part of why we have the surplus is also the pandemic. So the number one issue needs to be making sure that Californians come out of the pandemic solid, well cared for. And there are a lot of things we need to address. We need to make sure that people who have income insecurity around job loss and things like that relative to the pandemic are taken care of. So help with rent, help with mortgages, help with housing and food security. And then we have to really look at young people and what we're going to do to make up this year and a half of learning that has been lost for some or inequitable at best for most, and make sure that we pour resources into kids and into programs and teachers, and that we put money into workers, and that we focus on getting everyone back in California in a better place than they were before the pandemic started. I think it's really important that we use that money to position people in our state to be in a better spot than they were when we entered the pandemic in 2020. So I think that's the highest goal. Housing has to remain a top priority for California and especially Sacramento. And addressing homelessness for California is also always going to be a high priority until we find a way here to get ourselves to a better place where folks have more solutions and options.
What specifically could have been better in handling the COVID crisis in California?
Well, I think nationally, if we would have listened to science earlier, if we would have had the leadership that we have now nationally, when the pandemic started, I think we'd be in a lot better place. I think we lost time to an administration that turned their backs on science and didn't listen to progressive states like California. I think California fared better than most. Obviously, we're coming out of it faster, better, stronger than most states. But I think that is in large part because we bucked back against the national direction. If we would have had stronger leadership in Washington, D.C., like we do now, we would have been better off.
What are your thoughts, or where do you stand on the pending recall of Governor Newsom?
I think that the recall is a waste of money and a waste of time. I understand the frustration. It's been a year, an unprecedented time of job loss and closed restaurants and closed schools and lack of daycare and people really hurting and a lot of lost life. I lost one of my favorite people in this world last year too. I feel that hurt. And I know that there's a lot of pain, but I think what the world needs now is peacemakers. We need to find ways to unify and lift each other up. Recalls are expensive. They take a lot of time and attention, and I don't think it's worth our time or attention or resources right now. I think there are bigger, more important, pressing issues than a recall that we should be focused on.
Finally, you've had a number of successes over the more than a decade representing the Natomas area. You know, just to name a few, you helped get funding for the Aquatic Center. You have the health insurance company Centene in North Natomas. But looking back, what can you point to and say more could have been done?
That's a great question, and one I actually haven't been asked before. I think, you know, specific to my own corner of the world, I don't have a whole lot of regrets for Natomas. I wish I could have gotten us out of the building moratorium faster, which is the levy improvements. It took me almost 6 years to get that congressional act. And if I had done that sooner, maybe I could have gotten some more housing growth going faster. I wish I would have known more. When I first got there, one of the first fights I was asked to take up as a new council member was the loss of redevelopment. I would have been better at that fight at the end of my career than I was at the beginning. I wish I could have been more effective because I really believe the loss of that funding has hurt us tremendously. I had downtown as a council member for the first year before redistricting, and I wish I would have had them a little longer. I wish I could have done more to help the rail yards. I wish I could have gotten the Powerhouse Science Center funded faster. Although we got there eventually and they're going to open later this year. I'm a board member for that program and I have really enjoyed pushing for them for the last few years, but I had hoped they would open sooner. So I think most of my regrets are probably more around wishing I could have got things done quicker than they are about doing something differently. Obviously, in hindsight, there are a lot of things that, you know, knowing what you know now, if you had known there was a pandemic coming, maybe you would have done things differently, but I didn't. So I won't be so hard on myself or my council colleagues to assume we would have had fortune telling skills at the time.
Sacramento City Council member and Sacramento Mayor Pro Tem and District 6 candidate Angelique Ashby, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad you guys are doing this series. That's wonderful. Everyone will get a chance to hear from all the candidates. And I hope when they do, they'll consider supporting me.
Well, we have booked interviews with the three other candidates in the coming weeks. Sacramento pastor and activist Dr. Tecoy Porter will join us next Thursday at this time. Up next, too many distractions. Do you ever feel like you can't get a lot of work done working from home? Well, a new poll from the Greater Sacramento region shows most people feel the same exact way. So what can you do to get back on track? Plus, you can still email us your questions about the Pfizer vaccine for kids 12 to 15 years old. UC Davis's Dr. Blumberg answers your questions next. You can email those questions insight@capradio.org. You could also use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi, Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, when COVID hit, everything shut down. And for many people, you had to work from home. So have you been able to stay productive, or have you struggled and you just can't wait to get back into the office? I mean, work for many is also a place of camaraderie, social engagement, hopefully fun and fulfilling. But a recent CAP Radio Valley Vision survey found a majority of people, especially those with children in the house, have found they've just struggled working from home. Those surveyed live in Sacramento, Yolo, El Dorado, Placer, Yuba, and Sutter counties. And here are the results. 69% of people who responded and who have kids schooling at home or in a hybrid model say it's negatively affecting their ability to do their job. But there is some good news when it comes to impacting income. 57% say it has not impacted their income. So we're going to dive deeper into the issue of productivity while working from home, hopefully leave you with some solutions. Joining us is Jessica Hawthorne. She's Senior Vice President with the California Employers Association. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Oh, thanks for having me. You've done a beautiful job filling huge shoes, Vicky.
Oh, thank you. Well, Jessica, before we start, you know, we talk to people to get their firsthand experiences, and I think they really hit home what a lot of people are dealing with. We're going to listen to Shelley Williams. She's a single mom in Sacramento. She works on a national political campaign. Her kindergartner is doing hybrid schooling, and she says it's just hard to be productive while working at home. Take a listen.
On the Mondays, there is a conflict where he's supposed to start his class right around the time one of my staff meetings ends. So I have to like leave early from that meeting to get him set up. Today, I had a meeting that was happening during his class. So I have one ear on him, one ear on the conversation. I miss so much during meetings, right? Like, and I never know what I missed. I don't want to come back into the meeting and say, what, you know, can you guys go all the way back over everything you just said?
I think we're collectively hearing from listeners, me too, you know, just having that difficulty of that retention because you're pulled in so many directions. I would imagine that sounds familiar for you as well.
Yeah, so many of our members have dealt with the juggle. You know, you've got a kid over here, you've got a dog barking, you've got, you know, somebody knocking at your door, and you're really trying to focus on what you're trying to do. And I think that's why a lot of employers and employees are excited to get back to the office.
Yeah. Well, William says she feels supported by her employer, but she just doesn't feel like she's pulling her weight. You know, there's only so many hours in the day and there's so many responsibilities, you know, because of childcare responsibilities. So listen to just her experience with that.
I don't feel unsupported at all, but I do feel like a weak link is what I feel like. I feel like other people have to do more to make up for what I can't do. And I feel like I, you know, miss key things that, you know, can cause problems for others. So that's been kind of the consequences of it. But I haven't felt any like resentment or lack of care or support from my team. It's just, you know, we all want to pull our weight.
Yeah. So this is an employee who is a good employee and wants to be a team player and be collaborative, but just doesn't feel like they're pulling their own weight. What can employers do to make working from home a more positive experience, especially when you have kids at home?
It's a tough question. And early on, way back when this whole debacle started last year, those are the conversations people are having. Can people work from home? What does that look like? Do you have a station in your home that you can work that is comfortable and you can be productive? But as the pandemic went on, the dynamics changed. And I think a lot of employers forgot to continue having those crucial conversations with their teams. And is it working? Are you getting distracted? How can we support you can we adjust the time of certain meetings? Can we schedule meetings in a different location? Can you leave home from time to time? Can we put together some sort of childcare group that a bunch of parents share the resources? And it's an ongoing conversation. And I think what I hear every day is, well, now the kids are in school 4 days a week, but it's only 2 hours. Well, now the kids are in school 2 days a week, but the other 3 days, I've got to figure this out. And it changes every day. And I think as Americans and Sacramentans and Californians, we have pivoted beautifully. But at the end of the day, we need to pivot and communicate every day on an ongoing basis to address all these things that are happening, because the fatigue has really set in, I think. And now people are just like, I can't deal anymore. And as leaders in an organization, as employers, we have to say to employees, you're doing an amazing job. How can we support you? How can we make this easier for you? And put our heads together and come up with some creative solutions. Mm-hmm.
It seems like for Shelley, she has a good working relationship with her employer. But the reality is there are some bad situations out there. If you're an employee caught in that, what can an employee do in situations where they're not being given adequate space to deal with home issues?
Well, you know, that's going to depend on a lot of circumstances. If, I mean, Shelley's lucky, she's a diligent employee. It sounds like her employers would support her if she had that conversation. But every employee should be able to say to their employer, look, this isn't working. I need support. And if the employer says, no, we want it done this way, there is no middle ground, then an employee is in a tough situation, because it's a good job market. People are hiring. So put your feelers out there and see if there's a better fit for you. Because what I'm hearing from my recruiting team, our company's recruiting team, is that people can't find people at every level, from senior attorney down to entry level worker. People are hiring and they need people, and they're either giving bonuses or letting people work remotely, and they're being creative because recruiting is such a struggle right now. So I think if you have an employer who maybe won't adjust your schedule, maybe can't give you personal leave or schedule flexibility, things like that, look around, see what else is out there that maybe fits better. And remember, this is not a permanent situation. There are going to be some changes that will look different than pre-pandemic, but where we are today is not what it's going to look like in a month or 6 months.
Well, turning to the eventual return to work for many of us, when it comes to employers, logistically speaking, what should they be prepared for in welcoming employees back to the workplace and the challenges that still remain with that?
There's a couple issues. There's the what employers can do and what they have to do. And so if you are trying to bring people back in the workplace, the first thing you have to think about is if somebody has a religious or a medical reason, you have to accommodate that. But a lot of employees are just saying, I don't feel like coming back. I like being at home now. Well, think about that as an employer and say, why do I want people back in the workplace? We communicate better, we collaborate, we solve issues, we discuss. There's a lot of positive reasons. I read a survey yesterday where one employer sent everybody a care package with a mask and a cool mug saying, we can't wait to see you because we love to talk face to face. And those employees responded saying, yes, I can't wait to come back, thank you. Whereas other employers who said, it's time to come back, you're coming back on these days, see you then. Employees were like, I don't think so. So I think employers need to think about why you want them back and be prepared for the pushback. Excitement as well. Some employees are really excited, but it's worked for a lot of people for a long time. So it's important to think as an employer excitedly about why we want people back. So people will say, yes, I will come back. I'm excited about that. But be prepared. There's a lot of anxiety right now. People are comfortable with this new world that they're in, and they're scared. So is your safety plan, your COVID-19 safety plan implemented? Are you following it every day? Have you told employees that you're following it every day and how you're following it? And then are you giving people options? Well, let's start with 2 days and then let's ease back. The other thing I've heard is that if you start with more days, it's easier to take away days that you want them in the office to add them. So start with four. And then if people still need the flexibility and that works for you and your organization, then you say, okay, maybe we'll go back to three. Hmm. But I think what we've learned from all of our members is every situation is different for each employer and each employee that works for you. So a blanket approach and inflexibility is not going to work particularly well. You want to take each step as it comes and be open to being creative. I think we've learned that we have to be creative and flexible, and that will give you a lot of mileage.
Finally, I know that this is an ongoing conversation and it's subject to change, but what are you hearing from employers when it comes to requiring documentation for vaccination cards from their employees?
So employers are on multiple sides of this, and you can, as an employer, require vaccinations. Treat it as a medical record, meaning it needs to be in a separate file, limited access. It's not something that's announced to the whole world. You know, it's like any other medical condition. And a lot of employers want to have that vaccination record for contact tracing purposes, for response in their COVID-19 plan, any number of reasons. But I would caution employers to think critically about why you want to require the vaccination and how you're going to use that information. Because people have a right not to get that vaccination as well. And so you want to think about how that's going to impact your workplace. And I think if you have a workplace where people are working very closely with one another physically, that's a good reason to really get that information so you can make appropriate adjustments as necessary. But please don't be one of those employers that calls people out for not getting vaccinated. We're getting calls where there's some bullying in workplaces, either pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine, and that's not a conversation that's going to be productive. So as a leader in your organization, you want to be strategic about requiring that information, how you use that information, and supporting all your employees equitably.
Jessica Hawthorne is Senior Vice President with the California Employers Association. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you, Vicki. Have a great day.
You too. Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, we all know that as more people get vaccinated, more and more companies will be opening their doors back. Same goes with schools, especially as they plan for fall. This week, a big milestone was reached with the Pfizer vaccine. Yesterday, the CDC officially signed off on the Pfizer vaccine to be authorized for kids between the ages of 12 and 15, thus paving the way for millions more Americans to be vaccinated against COVID-19. But anecdotally, many parents and their kids are having the conversation. Will they get the vaccine? Should they wait and see? Will it be mandated to go back to school in the fall? What's the research with kids? Is it too soon? So they're all good questions and questions many families are having right now. And that's why we asked UC Davis's Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases, Dr. Dean Blumberg, to join us and help sift through all of those questions. Welcome back to Insight, Dr. Blumberg.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, doing great. Thanks. You know, I know that during the trials, there were children between the ages of 12 and 15 that participated in the Pfizer trials. What did we learn from them?
Yeah, so we had more than 2,000 children enrolled in the Pfizer trial for the 12 to 15-year-olds, and we found that the immune response was better than the comparator group, which was 16 to 25-year-olds, and that there were no infections in the vaccine group, 18 in the placebo group, and so the vaccine protected against disease also. And the vaccine was very well tolerated. The side effects were very similar to older young adults.
Now, fevers were slightly more common among individuals between 12 and 15-year-olds. Can you talk about the side effects and why they may be a little more intense for this group of children?
Yeah, their immune systems are different, and so they may react more strongly or sometimes less strongly, depending on the vaccine. But in this case, they did have more fevers. And to give you an idea of the fevers, they had 10% of children, 12 to 15-year-old, had fevers compared to 7.3% in the 16 to 25-year-old. So a few percent more had fevers. These fevers generally last for about a day or two and then go away. And most of them were mild to moderate.
Why did the CDC and I guess FDA as well wait to authorize it for children between the ages of 12 to 15?
Well, they need the data first. So before it's going to be approved or authorized for use in any age group, they need the data to show that it's safe and that it is effective. So the studies need to be done. The data needs to be collected. They need to present it to the FDA. All this, for people who'd like to see the data, it's all available online. The CDC data, the FDA data, it's all available. You can look at the graphs, all the numbers and everything. But they need to be transparent about that to make sure that people have confidence that the vaccine is safe and effective.
Given that you're a doctor of pediatric infectious diseases and looking at the data, are there any overarching unknowns that stand out to you?
There were really no surprises at all. I mean, it was the children had excellent immune responses. We've seen that with other vaccines, for example, with HPV vaccine, that the younger children had better immune responses compared to older individuals. So there were really no surprises with that. But you never know with the vaccines, because sometimes the dose may need to be adjusted. Maybe you need to give a higher dose since they've been less experienced with their immune systems, or sometimes a lower dose because for weight-based dosing because they're smaller.
Yeah, I was looking at the Kaiser Family Foundation. They just released a recent survey. They polled individuals in April, and it was just published a few days ago. 3 in 10 parents of children between the ages of 12 and 15 say they'll get their child vaccinated. That's about 30%. However, a quarter say that they're going to wait and see how the vaccine is working. What do you say to those parents?
Yeah, I think it's fine for them to wait if they're uncomfortable. A lot of people don't want to be first in line and they want to wait to see that there's more experience. You know, we do know that we do have a robust experience with these COVID vaccines now compared to just in December when they first came out. I mean, in the U.S., there's been more than 260 million doses of vaccine administered, and worldwide, more than 1.3 billion doses of COVID vaccines have been administered. So we've got really robust experience with these vaccines. All the news is continuing to come out that they are safe and effective. But if parents want to wait in this age group to have more children vaccinated, they're welcome to do that. I mean, the vaccines are being rolled out across the U.S. I would think that within a few weeks, we'll get reports from the CDC showing additional data of safety and effectiveness.
What about the other two vaccines that currently have emergency use authorization, Moderna and J&J? Are they currently being considered for children as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Moderna is pretty far along in their studies in younger children. They're studying children 12 to 17 year old, and Johnson & Johnson also has studies ongoing in children. And there's studies also in even younger children, less than 12 years of age, less than 11.
Do you think that schools will mandate the vaccine in order to return to class in fall, especially if the vaccine gets full approval?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, is that nobody's going to mandate this vaccine until there is full approval. And Pfizer-BioNTech has applied for full approval to the FDA. This process is quite formal and generally will take several months. So that's not going to happen until at least the fall or the winter. But once there's full approval, then I think we should have a discussion about whether this should be a required immunization for schools, similar to the measles vaccine, for example. And that will be, you know, decided at the state level, the legislature. And I'm sure we'll have a robust discussion about that. But this is certainly one that I think is reasonable to consider mandating for schools, since we know that it is transmitted via the respiratory route. So normal activities at school will result in opportunities for transmission.
When looking at the 12 to 15-year-olds who participated in the trial, there were over 2,000 of them. Do we know the demographics of these children in the studies?
Yeah, all those numbers are publicly available. And at the ACIP meeting that was conducted yesterday, they presented that data at that meeting, and the slides are available online.
Yesterday, Governor Newsom said that he expects the mask mandate to potentially be lifted on June 15th if the, you know, state fully reopens, and it seems like that's going to happen, except for when gathering in large crowds. Do you think, are we there yet? Do you have any concerns about that if it does move forward?
You know, I think in California, we've really opened things up in a very measured fashion. So it's been very stepwise. There's been no dramatic changes. I think that's perfectly appropriate considering all the surges that we've seen before. So I'm confident that the current plans for opening up are appropriate. And then we can dial things back if there is a sudden surge also. And we've seen that done before. We're doing very well in California in terms of the number of people who have been vaccinated. We're doing better than the national average. In California, more than 60% of people have received at least one dose of vaccine, and 46% of people are fully vaccinated. So we're getting near that herd immunity level. I think we're doing very well.
Finally, because this is always evolving and we're learning more and more, is there any new information about the vaccine efficacy against variants?
You know, there is some information that's trickling in about how the current vaccines are doing against the variants. And the results are very promising. So there is theoretical concerns based on taking people's blood who've been vaccinated and in the laboratory neutralizing the virus after vaccination. And there's lower neutralizing activity against the variants versus the previous circulating strains. But in practice, what we're seeing is that the vaccines are working very well, maybe not quite as well, maybe not that 90 to 95% protection, but about 75% protection against the South African variant, which was one of concern. We don't have as more robust experience with the Brazilian variant, so we'll have to wait for more data from that.
Dr. Dean Blumberg is UC Davis's Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases. Thanks, as always, for joining us on Insight.
Thank you.
Still ahead, we are going to talk to the author of Bad Tourist: Misadventures in Love and Travel. I'm Vicky Gonzalez, and you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Bad Tourist: Misadventures in Love and Travel is a new book authored by Lake Tahoe writer Susan Roberts. And this is not your average travel book. In fact, the description of the book calls it an anti-travel book, guidebook. Instead, it's a memoir and travel essays, which are sometimes funny, confessional, and unapologetic. Suzanne Roberts lives in South Lake Tahoe, and she is the current El Dorado County Poet Laureate, and she teaches creative writing at Sierra Nevada University. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the title of your book is called Bad Tourist. So what does it mean to be a bad tourist?
Well, that title's a little bit tongue-in-cheek in that when we think of tourists or the word tourists, it has a little bit of a negative connotation. People like to call themselves travelers. And so I used bad tourists as a way of being ironic, because I think that when we travel to new places, we are confronted with cultural differences, and we have our own cultural blind spots. And so that creates problems, and we make mistakes, and whether they're small mistakes or big mistakes is one thing. But I think that we can't help but being bad tourists. And when we realize that our default is to be the bad tourist because we're making mistakes we're unaware of, then I think we can become better tourists and better travelers.
Your book is funny, but it also has serious issues such as poverty and privilege, and also, you know, what it means to be a woman in the world, a solo traveler at times. So how did you balance the humor with those more serious issues?
Well, I think that the way into difficult subjects is always through humor. And I think in our biggest hardships, our most difficult moments, whether it's the death of a loved one or witnessing something really difficult in the world, we must bring humor to it. you know, life is comedy and tragedy. And I think that they both go together. And so when I write about something that, you know, that's hard, I think that a way to attract a reader is to start with something funny or to make fun of myself. An example from my book, I wrote about visiting the San Blas Islands, and my husband and I went to this island where they were all young travelers and we were middle-aged, and so we were no longer interested in loud drinking games and the things that they were interested in. And so I started the essay by making fun of myself and making fun of the other travelers and talking about, you know, this sort of island paradise and how I was out of place, but also how I was uncomfortable. There was a crab in my bed and sand in my underwear. But then I move into the more serious topic of the fact that these islands are disappearing and might disappear in our lifetime because of rising seas and climate change. And so I start the essay with something funny and light to kind of bring the reader in, but then also to say, you know, our travels are full of comedy and tragedy side by side.
You have traveled to 4 continents, 15 countries in your book. And, you know, for a lot of them or many of them, you were traveling alone. What advice do you have for solo women travelers?
Well, I think, you know, the advice I have for solo women travelers is the advice I have for any traveler, and that is to do research first. And I think that's one of the ways that we can be better bad tourists, is to research places that are locally owned, maybe environmentally friendly, staying away from, you know, mega resorts and all-inclusive, but also for women travelers, doing research in places where we might feel safe. And also, you know, to understand that, yes, we have to be aware of our surroundings, but that our fear of other places is sometimes unfounded. Some of the places I've traveled where people say, oh, that's such a dangerous place, I haven't felt any danger at all. And sometimes, you know, in our country, we have, you know, we have so many guns, we have a lot of violence, we have a lot of dangers here at home. And so I think it's important to remember that other places are not as dangerous as you might have heard. Mm. And also, the thing that's scariest might be the thing that creates the most confidence, might be the thing that you overcome. For me, the scariest part about traveling alone was I was so afraid of getting sick by myself, you know, and that happened to me. I got food poisoning in Peru. I was all alone. I thought I was going to die, and I didn't die. And that created self-confidence and strength that I could handle even the thing that I thought was going to be the scariest.
What do you think travel will look like now that we're kind of rounding the corner to post-pandemic? Individuals are getting vaccinated. They've been cooped up for the past year, and they're booking their plane flights and hotels. What do you think travel will look like?
Well, I think my guess is as good as anyone else's, but I do know that, back to research, I think we need to research places. I think there's going to be a shift back to using travel advisors because of the navigation of all of the different, you know, COVID tests, vaccine requirements, all of those things. So I think that as travelers, we need to be really flexible, and we need to go to places with a huge amount of compassion and empathy, because we may have quarantine fatigue. We may be tired of Zoom, but we're going to places often where people are going to be serving our food, you know, the flight attendants who have been, they've been risking their life this entire time. And I think it's going to, you know, it's going to require a great amount of compassion on our part. For me, I know I'm going to continue staying close to home. My husband and I got a van, as so many people did, and we're going to be traveling domestically for a while, even though we're both vaccinated, just out of safety and out of respect for places. Other places don't have the vaccine like we do, and I think that's something really important for us to remember.
Yeah, for people who do want to, you know, just hit the road, do a road trip, and stay local. I mean, you live in South Lake Tahoe. That is a huge tourist destination, and you are a travel writer passing along advice. What would you like people to know when they head to very popular destinations such as South Lake Tahoe, which is also your home?
Well, there's been a lot written recently in a lot of news outlets about over-tourism in South Lake Tahoe, and Tahoe in general, Truckee, North Lake Tahoe, Incline. And I think what I want people who are coming to know is that we're a welcoming bunch. Our locals, we know that tourism is a really important part of our economy, but we also want people to, again, do research, be aware of the unique environment, that even though we might be 2 hours from Sacramento, we have a unique wilderness environment that requires a lot of care. So, you know, we've always sort of dealt with things that were annoying, like traffic or crowded beaches. But when it comes to things that are dangerous, right, like we're in a severe drought, right, don't have a campfire and be really careful if you're a smoker with your cigarette butts. I mean, these are the ways that the last two fires in our area started. Also, you know, if you see a garbage can that's not open or that isn't being serviced, don't just leave your garbage right next door to it, because the bears will come and eat the garbage. They'll become acclimated to people, and then the bears will have to be destroyed. And so there's a real danger to the environment and to our wildlife that if you just know a little bit, you know, don't feed the ducks, don't feed the geese, they're wild animals. So if you just bring a little bit of awareness and do a little bit of research, then I think, you know, everybody will be much happier and the locals will continue to be welcoming as we have been.
All right, Suzanne, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much. And your new book is Bad Tourist, Misadventures in Love and Travel. We have a link to her book on our website, insight@capradio.org. We'll see you Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.